bear the thought of losing his fame. So he behaved the way the male athlete too often behaves, doing anything he could to draw attention to himself. I saw countless male athletes like OJ. They were not as extreme, but their need for power and fame and public spectacle became even more intense after their careers because they knew it was the only way not to be what they feared the most, forgotten. For all our profound personal differences, our careers had shared many similarities. He seized the attention of the nation when he played football at the University of Southern California, capped off with a Heisman Trophy and the indelible image of him running for a 64-yard touchdown to beat UCLA in 1967 in one of the greatest college football games of all time. It put him high atop a public pedestal that only grew higher when he played pro football for the Buffalo Bills and set a single-season rushing record in 1973 with 2,003 yards. I likewise seized the attention of the nation when I won the decathlon, capped off with setting a world record on live television and the indelible image of the victory lap I took waving the American flag. We both became the faces of major brands, OJ with Hertz and I with Wheaties. We both became sportscasters for ABC and later NBC. We both did motivational speeches. We both had modest film careers. We were both on the charity golf and tennis tournament circuit. We both knew what it was like to feel that pedestal, like a block of ice, begin to melt, and the inevitability that others will take our places. Because we had much in common, there perhaps should have been a lot for us to share and talk about. But there wasn't. We may have been of the same world, but we were not in the same world. If I looked in the mirror and loathed myself, I looked at OJ and saw a monster of a male athlete. I wonder if this contributed to my feelings of awkwardness around him, that even if he embodied an archetype I hated, it was also the archetype that people expected from me. There were other contributing factors in my distaste for him. He was the most narcissistic, egocentric, neediest asshole in the world of sports I had ever seen, and I had seen a lot of them. I first met OJ at the U.S. Olympic Trials in Eugene, Oregon, in 1976. I was competing and he was broadcasting. I saw him after that at a charity tennis tournament in Forest Hills when we were both invited as celebrities. I always found him affable, but I also felt he was trying with every fiber of his soul to be affable. The more I saw of him, the more I felt he was never genuine. I eventually found him exhausting and pathetic, his need for one-upmanship such that it was almost like he was on the football field again, in which everyone else was an opponent. I was always wary. Chris's relationship to OJ also went back a long time. He had been an usher at her wedding to Robert Kardashian in 1978. When Chris first mentioned OJ to me, the marriage between him and Nicole was fundamentally over. Chris told me that Nicole hated him to such a degree that she once had said to her, "Every time he gets on a plane, I hope it crashes." The week after Chris shared Nicole's comment with me, I saw OJ at the Robert F. Kennedy Charity Golf Tournament in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. He was practicing putts. He was friendly, but he also had to know that Chris and I were dating and that Chris had probably told me about the dark depth of his relationship with Nicole. Right away, as we exchanged pleasantries, I could see him going into the male athlete mode of, "Everything is perfect because I'm supposed to be perfect." He was also putting on a show for me, wanting me to think that everything between him and Nicole was cool. I was cordial, as I always am. "So, how's everything going with you?" "Hey, when your wife's happy, you're happy." "Wait a second." I thought, "Your wife just told Chris she wishes you were dead, so it can't be that good." I continued the conversation just to get it over with. "Hey, that's great." It became even stranger when OJ said he had taken a Learjet from New York for the tournament, and it was so crowded that he had to sit on the toilet in the back. He made fun of it, and I laughed along with him. But once again, I was thinking something very different. That would have made your wife even happier. The pathological need of OJ to still be the big man on campus came sharply into focus when we were in New Orleans to cover the 1992 U.S. Olympic trials for NBC. All the broadcasters used earpieces so the lead producer could communicate with us during the event. During commercial breaks, a song that was popular at the time by Salt and Peppa came blaring through. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. The song was like water torture after a while. It stuck to your brain. It was driving me berserk. It was driving everyone berserk. Except OJ, belting out the lyrics every time it came on. Others laughed, but I found it sad. This desperation to be noticed. The need for cheers in any situation. Chris was in town with me, so we made plans with OJ to have dinner that night at a vintage New Orleans French restaurant. We got there early. All I wanted to do was be discreet, get in and get dinner and get out without attention, since I was still frequently recognized. The restaurant, I think it was Galatoire's, had a steady hum, and that was the sound of eating remarkable food. 1,000 great and famous dignitaries and celebrities had eaten there. OJ walked in 15 minutes later with his posse. His notion of quiet was to sing at the top of his lungs, "Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me." If you didn't know Juice was in the house, you surely would now. The singing also had the desired effect. Other diners turned in their chairs and started yelling, "Juice! Juice!" So much for the uninterrupted sound of eating. He kept on singing like a downtown Vegas casino act. We finished dinner and walked out onto Bourbon Street. The street was noisy. It was hard to imagine anyone wanting to make it noisier, except OJ, who was loud and boisterous and needed the crowd yelling, "Juice! Juice! Juice!" just like he was back playing UCLA. We stopped in front of a strip club. The line was 30 deep. As many people recognized me as they did OJ, but I was not about to crash the line. They had been waiting. Not OJ. He went right by high-fiving people as he walked right in. Once again, the cries of "Juice! Juice!" I had never been to a place like this. I know I was supposed to like it, because that is an essential part of the male athlete. Stripper poles and revolving balls of light. I hated such clubs, because whatever money the workers made, I could only assume, based on stories from other athletes, was from an interaction that was always demeaning women and ogling them and trying to grope them. The idea of getting a lap dance, even for the hell of it, was sickening to me. But it was also a slippery slope, because I could not seem to be turned off. I tried to act as comfortable as possible, at least as if I was amused. But once again, it only heightened for me the assumptions of gender that society imposes upon us. Women this way, and men that way, and the male athlete a species unto himself. All I had to do was look at OJ to see those expectations fulfilled, drinking and laughing and having lap dances like nobody's business. Much of my interaction with OJ was on the golf course. I am a good golfer, and OJ wasn't. It drove him crazy that I was better, his macho core such that he always had to win at everything, which is probably why he lied about the number of strokes he had taken and kicked the ball to get a better lie when he thought nobody was looking. I made small talk one time by mentioning a company I had signed with, and OJ immediately said, "Oh yeah, I know the CEO. We are really good friends." After a while, I never brought up anything because I knew OJ's inevitable response would be that he had done it first and he had done it better. I could not imagine being married to him and having to feed his insatiable ego day in and day out. The more I learned, the more obvious it became that the slightest thing set him off. About 6 months before the 1994 murders, Chris and I hosted our annual Christmas Eve party. Nicole and OJ at this point had been divorced for a little over a year, but Chris and I wanted to be friendly, so we invited both of them on the assumption they would bring their two children. We had also invited a friend named Joseph Perulli, who had dated Nicole after the divorce. OJ hated Perulli. When Perulli left Nicole's house, he would sometimes see OJ down the street watching in his car. So Chris called Perulli. "Listen, OJ is coming. Maybe you should not come." "I have a gift to drop off. I will just get there early." OJ came to the party with Nicole and their children before the other guests. He was in good spirits, hugs all around. We always had Santa Claus come, and the kids were excited. Since it was early, we were relieved that Perulli had decided not to come at all. Then he walked in. OJ was in the entryway by the front door when he saw him. "Hi." He went into the living room. Chris came up to me. She was very nervous, which she almost never gets, as was Nicole. "Go in the other room. Talk to OJ. We are getting Joseph out of here." I went into the living room, where there were two couches opposite one another with a coffee table in the middle. I sat down. OJ was just staring ahead. I looked at him to see if anything would register, and it did not. I tried to engage him. "Hey, OJ, have you played any golf recently?" Nothing. Not a blink of the eye. Nothing. I had never been with anybody with such a reaction, or more precisely, a non-reaction like that. He literally was not there. I could not get up and leave without trying one more time. "Hey, OJ, I'm off Thursday. Want to play golf?" Nothing. I left and found Chris. "This is the strangest thing I have ever seen in my life. He's like, not even there." I asked him some questions, and he was staring into space. OJ got up, found Nicole and the kids, and essentially grabbed them. "We're leaving." Several months after the party, Chris and I were in bed watching the news at around 10:30 p.m. when we got a call from Nicole.
"Where's Chris?"
"She's right here."
"Put her on the line."
She wanted to talk to both of us, so we placed the call on speaker. We had a mutual friend named Faye Resnick. She was great when she was sober, but also had a cocaine problem and a very addictive personality. We had not seen her for a while, so we were concerned something was up. Nicole confirmed it.
"Faye got back into drugs, and if she doesn't stop, she's going to kill herself. She will just keep taking drugs until she dies. We need to have an intervention. We have to get a group together who knows her and do it tonight."
"Tonight?"
"She has to be in rehab by the morning. That's our goal."
We got dressed and went to Starbucks to get some coffee and picked up Nicole at her house. Then we went to Faye's. We walked in and there was Faye, and I wished all my children could have been here to see what drugs can do. Faye was a thin, attractive woman who always cared about the way she looked, but now she was completely disheveled and had lost 30 pounds and was almost skeletal. There were about 6 or 7 of us who gathered, including her ex-husband and ex-boyfriend. We all were fundamentally saying the same thing. "Faye, you have to go to rehab."
"Oh, I'm fine."
We went through her purse and found cocaine. We started cleaning up the house, which was a mess. Over and over, Nicole kept saying the same thing to Faye.
"If you don't stop, you're going to die, and you don't want your daughter to grow up without a mother."
I was listening to the urgency and sincerity and love in Nicole's voice. She, more than anyone else in my mind, was the one who got her to rehab the next morning. 3 or maybe 4 days afterward, Nicole was dead. Still to this day, I wish we had known that the person we needed to save in that room at that very moment was Nicole.
As serious as Faye's situation was, Nicole's was even more life-threatening. It was her children who would grow up without a mother. I was in Chicago playing in a celebrity golf tournament on June 13, 1994, when somebody drove up to me in a cart and said I had to call home because there was an emergency. I instantly feared someone in the family had gotten hurt. I immediately called Chris, who was crying over the phone.
Nicole is dead. Nicole is dead. Nicole is dead.
What?
You have to come home right away.
Chris did not know the circumstances, whether it was a robbery or home invasion or what. I threw my stuff into my suitcase and headed for the airport. I did not know until later that OJ had been in Chicago as well, playing in a different golf tournament. I did not know that until after the murders of Nicole and Ron Goldman the night of June 12, 1994, he had left for the Windy City the same night, presumably to give himself an alibi. When I got to the ticket counter, the agent recognized me and smiled and casually uttered what would turn out to be the creepiest thing ever said to me. A chilling reminder that no matter how different OJ and I were, people would always perceive us as being from the same male athlete gender mold, recognizable celebrities because of our sports accomplishments, peas in the same pod. Oh, OJ had to get back to Los Angeles too. I have tried to erase OJ from my mind. Everybody I know has. I believe he got away with two savage murders, but the trial caused enormous tension within the family because of all the improbably woven strands. Chris and I, knowing the background of OJ and Nicole and her hatred and fear of him, believed he had done it the minute we heard of her murder and the circumstances surrounding it. Because of Robert Kardashian's relationship to OJ, being on his defense team and one of his long-standing friends, Robert's daughters Courtney and Kim were on OJ's side. Chloe was too young to really understand. The case was impossible to discuss. Two daughters firm in the conviction that he hadn't done it because of their father's involvement, and their mother and stepfather firm in the conviction that he had done it. When OJ was found not guilty, Courtney came into the house after school and said to me, "See, I told you he didn't do it." I am always cognizant of my role of stepfather, but this was one of the rare moments where I just stepped in without checking with Robert first, because that simply wasn't possible given his role in the trial. I took both Courtney and Kim aside privately and explained to them that a jury finding of not guilty did not mean that OJ was innocent of two murders. I also said to them, "The name of O.J. Simpson will never be mentioned in this house again." It wasn't. But it still lingered in so many different ways, because he would always haunt us. I always wondered why Robert Kardashian was so aligned with O.J. They had both gone to the University of Southern California, Robert had helped him on business deals, and there was no doubt that their friendship was deep and sincere, and that they both saw admirable qualities in one another. But his defense of OJ was so extreme, given Robert's impeccable character. When I tried to sort it out, I wondered if it somehow had to do with Chris. The divorce still devastated Robert. Everybody knew that. And now Chris, at that point in the 1990s, was appearing in hundreds of infomercials with me, looking lean and fit and happy as we promoted our exercise equipment. I wondered if Robert saw all this and began to think she was becoming something of a celebrity, and it ate away at him. Until the OJ case, when he became a superstar and completely overshadowed her. All of a sudden, he was the one all over TV, and I wonder if it was his way of saying to her what I think she was saying to him when she married me. A big fuck you. Long after the trial and the verdict of not guilty, Robert and I were in the car one day. We had always been friendly to one another and liked one another. We talked all the time about parenting. We never talked much about the trial. The look of shock on his face when OJ was acquitted had become famous because of its very indication that he was shocked by the verdict. In a subsequent interview with Barbara Walters on ABC's 2020, he did admit that he had doubts about the verdict in light of the blood evidence against Simpson. But that was as far as he went. I don't even know why the trial came up in our conversation. At that point, there had been two of them, the criminal trial in Los Angeles Superior Court and the civil trial in the same court, in which a jury quickly concluded that O.J. had done it and held him liable for millions of dollars in worthless damages because he didn't have any money. The hysteria had died down, so maybe Robert felt comfortable. Or maybe his guard was down. Or maybe he didn't care anymore. But he turned and said to me, "I would have been okay with it if they had gotten him in the first trial." The implication was obvious that he believed O.J. was guilty. But there is no way of knowing now what he exactly meant, since he tragically died of cancer in 2003 at the age of 59. Just as there was no way of him knowing that the name Kardashian would one day become a pop culture phenomenon all over the world, or that his children and Chris would collectively become impossibly famous, or that his ex-wife's husband would one day be called Caitlin. April 4, 2016. It was only a game. I am in Eugene. I am returning to one of the most legendary track and field facilities in the world on the University of Oregon campus. The Nike shoe was invented here by the then Oregon track coach Bill Bowerman and Phil Knight, a middle distance runner at the university. I cannot possibly match such accomplishments. But I was invented here as well. The first time the name of Bruce Jenner became associated with the Olympics. I came out of nowhere in 1972 when I finished third in the U.S. Olympic trials. I never went back to nowhere again as an athlete. I am here for Sports Illustrated. They are doing a cover story on the 40th anniversary of my win in the 1976 Games. Some of the photographs are being taken by Heinz Klutmeier, who also shot pictures of me competing in the Games for the magazine. "All right," read the headline of the magazine cover in capital yellow letters after I won, looking as tall as Times Square neon. Beneath, "Bruce Jenner wins big." The story will be part of Sports Illustrated's Where Are They Now issue, appearing in July 2016, featuring such other athletes as Ken Griffey Jr., Drew Bledsoe, and William Perry. There are about a dozen of us named in all. We have all traveled a long way from then to now, some more remembered than others. But it is safe to say that none of the other male athletes honored now wear a blouse or a dress or a gown or a pantsuit, at least in public. I am sitting at the end of a long bench at Hayward Field, painted in the dark green of the University of Oregon colors. It isn't a field, but a track and field shrine, with seating for 10,500, and the host of the U.S. Olympic trials six times, including 1972 and 1976, when I competed. The Nike origins only add to the legend, from a track shoe inspired by a waffle iron into a company with a market capitalization of $100.1 billion. It is early morning, and the sun is rising. I am in the cold of shadow and then the warmth of light. And while I prefer the light better, I am not uncomfortable with the shadow, since I spent so much of my life there. I am gazing out onto the oval of the track, sitting on a bench. It is the pose of pondering that photographers and magazine editors resort to suggest reflection and the ooze of nostalgia over past triumphs, since I had three distinct ones here. I cooperate with a producer who is doing a companion video for Sports Illustrated Films to the written piece by Tim Layden. There are several videographers and, of course, Heinz. I was on a mission to make something out of myself after finishing third here in the trials in 1972 and being such an unknown that the New York Times misidentified me in its wrap-up. In 1975, I set a world record here. In the 1976 trials here before Montreal, I broke it. But it was all just a game, just sports. Maybe that sounds dismissive. Without my athletic accomplishments, I would not be writing these words, or no one would care if I were writing them. I know that. It was only a game because of what I know now, what I feel now, that the only worthy self is the true self. It is not the sole province of those living their lives in the wrong gender, or those discovering their sexual preference, but in anyone who is different and feels different and wants to celebrate that difference as a natural outgrowth of our humanity, defined not by what others believe, but the beautiful singularity of our hearts and souls. If I ponder anything, it is not the past but my present and my future. Life is wonderful today, as I have just passed my first anniversary after transition, although not without its conflicts, and sometimes being a piñata for the media. I am used to it, of course. They bother me for a little bit, and then the bother goes away. They are forgotten in the bottomless pit of the internet. But sometimes they linger, and they do hurt and cause damage, and not just to me. Like the story floated by a Canadian writer named Ian Halperin, desperately and pathetically trying to generate publicity for some silly book he wrote on the Kardashians. Halperin claimed in an interview that I was unhappy and considering transitioning back to Bruce. The story was 100% wrong and garbage and swill. But the story went viral and was printed all over the world, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, without verification. They legitimized the story, making it seem like fact. The other problem with these stories, the problem virtually everyone in the public spotlight faces, is that there is no recourse. So I want to make the point here one more time as emphatically as I can. I have never been happier. Transitioning back? It's the opposite. Halperin's story has another pernicious effect. In church, I met a teenager who wanted to transition, but was having difficulty convincing his parents. I gave him my phone number so he could talk to an understanding voice. He called me one day and said that his father read the story about my alleged desire to transition back and was using it as ammunition against his son. In other words, the son would regret it just as Caitlyn Jenner regretted it. I can only convey to the father that the story is totally false. But who knows whether I will be believed or not? It would be a terrible tragedy if I'm not. We move down to the track itself. The producer wonders if it is not impossible to want to run again, or at least bounce around on the track a little bit. I do so in an exaggerated way, so I purposely look clownish. He wants me to say I miss being back here. What a big part of my life it was. I say the appropriate words, but my heart isn't in it. Actually, being on the track makes me realize how much I don't want to run at all. It's the same with the shot I find when cleaning out the garage in Malibu. I look at it, think about picking it up for old time's sake, realize I have no interest in the shot put anymore, and roll it several feet into a corner. I know it would be great for the cameras for a tear to come to my eye, but there is really no sense of nostalgia for me. Bruce may be stuck here, and that's fine. Caitlin never was, and never will be. Chapter 11. No Way Out. Chris and I are watching a television show on MTV one night called The Osbournes. It is about a family of four living in Beverly Hills, presided over by Ozzy Osbourne, a heavy metal god whose days of biting off the heads of bats at raucous concerts are behind him. The show is amusing. Watching Ozzy in a domesticated role as a father and husband has its moments. He seems like he is intoxicated half the time, and he later admits he was intoxicated all the time during the shooting of each episode from 2002 to 2005. Under our own roof, we now have six children, five daughters and a son.
The house is awash in puberty and adolescence and young adulthood and two parents with very different styles. It seems to me something is there for television. Chris says she is the one who came up with the idea and decided to actively pitch it to Ryan Seacrest, the host of the enormously popular American Idol and a television producer looking for projects. Chris knows Seacrest. A meeting is held with him and he loves the concept. The next step is to meet with the E! Network's vice president of original programming, Lisa Berger. She is not so in love. I don't know if I get it. The only person in the room I know of is Bruce. Seacrest keeps pushing. In 2007, Berger gives a tepid green light for 4 episodes, largely because I am in the public eye and maybe that's a hook. It is now in its 12th season and the most successful reality show in the history of television. Everybody in my family has a different personality that is incorporated into the show. I am the well-meaning but confused and helpless father and husband. I get love, but very little respect. I'm fine with that, because it is largely accurate. Plus, I have stood on the public platform earlier in my life. I don't need that anymore. The women on the show want to be out front, and that is cool with me. I rarely watch unless I am actively involved in an episode. I know that my mother is embarrassed, as are other members of her family. In 2008, my Aunt Ellie sends a letter to Chris and me to our home in Hidden Hills. What a disappointment you are to your public, Bruce. I haven't heard one complimentary thing from anyone yet. The consensus is that you look like a milky toast and henpecked husband and stepfather. You do look very uncomfortable in every scene you were in. The implication is that I have sold myself out, willingly destroyed what positive reputation I have left. Pretty much on the mark. I still feel weak and inferior. I still have no self-respect. I feel as trapped in the middle between male and female as I ever have been. So maybe it's only fitting that I am treated on the show like a new version of electrolysis without painkillers. Reality show humiliation. But I don't care. The impetus for doing it is that the money generated will create a healthy trust fund for all the Kardashian kids, and especially for Kendall and Kylie. I hope the exposure parlays into something bigger, which it does. There is no family that is better known, not just in America, but maybe the world, given that the show is aired in 150 countries and all the kids have branched out so far beyond it. If it seems like Chris intimidates me at times, that's because she does. She was confident and sure of herself when I met her and becomes even more so as the show takes off. With me, it's the flip side. I am more lacking in confidence and unsure of myself than I was when I met her. But I also wonder if the public's perceptions of both of us are based on stereotypic roles of male and female behavior. The male in the household is supposed to be assertive, in control, the captain, particularly if the male is an Olympic gold medalist. Because I am not, I am labeled weak. Chris, on the other hand, as the female in the household, is supposed to be subservient, non-aggressive, letting the male make all the major decisions. Because she is not, she is often labeled as an overbearing bitch. We both play against expected gender type, and to a certain degree, we are targeted for it. From a deeply personal standpoint, keeping up with the Kardashians is a demarcation for Chris and me. I believe that the more successful it becomes, the less she needs me. I am not the primary breadwinner anymore. I feel increasingly irrelevant. I receive a healthy paycheck for doing the show, and I continue to do speeches, but I never see a dime of it. It all goes right to Chris. Plus, what I make is nothing compared to the kids because of all their other ventures. Chris, in addition to being the show's executive producer, also takes a 10% cut from the Kardashian kids as the so-called momager. She trademarked the title in 2015. I do not have a checking account. I have a credit card, but purchases are carefully pored over. Chris is incredibly generous, on her own terms. She buys me a Porsche after I express interest in getting one, but no, I can't. She does put the title in her name. She buys me a membership to the exclusive Sherwood for somewhere around $200,000 so I can play golf. They are amazing gestures, but it is becoming increasingly difficult for me not to make any financial decisions on my own. Actually, I can't make any. What keeps me going, what always kept me going during much of the 23 years of marriage, was being a father to the Kardashians and Kendall and Kylie. I got heavily into carpooling, made tricky because at one point they attended several different schools. I often woke up at 5:30 in the morning, then made sure the kids were fed and out the door by 6:30. Courtney and Kim were going at the time to Marymount High School next to UCLA. Chloe had gone to a variety of schools, and I didn't always carpool her. I dropped them off in the thick of traffic, then returned home. I picked up Kendall and Kylie and took them to preschool in Bel Air, which meant going through the traffic I just came back from, L.A. traffic. I dropped them off and then had to pick them up at 12:30 and bring them home. Then I had to drive all the way back to pick up Courtney and Kim from Marymount and take them home. This particular routine went on for 3 years. Some days it took 6 hours. Welcome to the life I had made for myself. But I liked it. It was an opportunity to talk to the kids. It also got me out of the house. Chris rarely carpooled, particularly as the business of managing the Kardashians became increasingly thriving and complex. She also had me to do the driving. The more successful Kardashian Inc., which includes Kendall and Kylie, the more obvious it is that Chris wants me out of the house as much as possible, probably because I really do nothing when I am around, and it drives her crazy. The gender issues are percolating again by the late 2000s. More than ever, I crave going on the road and doing my hotel routine. The rise of the internet over the previous decade has also opened up a new world for me. I can read the personal stories of people wondering if they should transition and watch them on YouTube and realize I am not the only one going through such torment as they cope with their own gender dysphoria. I read about trans men and women who, now that they have transitioned, celebrate themselves and for the first time in their lives love themselves for who they are. I watch the medical procedures that can be performed, including the final surgery. I wonder more than ever what it would be like to get rid of my penis one day, this silly and useless lump of skin that irritates the hell out of me. But watching the surgery is not pleasant. I don't make it all the way through. Another great benefit of the internet is online shopping. I still need to be careful so I don't go crazy. Since Chris screens my purchases, I use someone else's debit card. But I am lucky. If my family has more makeup per household than any in America, it also has more packages. How will they possibly notice a little one for me? But I am still paranoid. If there is one, I try to intercept it almost as soon as it is delivered. But sometimes I can't get there in time. Then Chris retrieves it. Oh, this is for you. Thanks. A bullet dodged. I buy a few items of clothing, a couple of bras. Mostly it is silicone forms for your breasts and hips and buttocks. Maybe this sounds easy to you, but it's not. My store of choice is the Breast Form store. The selection is amazing on all fronts, but in breast forms alone there are such styles as Amona, Amelux, Aphrodite, Divine, Gold Seal, Nearly Me, Platinum Seal, Silver Seal, and several more, not including ones for sleeping and travel and swimming. So it's complicated. You don't want one too small. You don't want one too big. Each of the breast styles has a different feel. Plus, there are nipple styles to choose from. Thank God I went to college. When it comes to forms for the buttocks,
I keep two sizes in my little closet, a small one and one a little bigger, depending on my mood. I also learn early on that the gel ones are much better than the padded ones. The gel ones look real. The padded ones look like you have padding. After many years of experimentation and practice, I am really getting my routine down. To wear a wig right, you need to tamp down and hide your hair as much as possible so that it almost feels like you were putting the wig on your bare skull. I have seen movies where people wear skull caps before putting on wigs, but I don't know where to buy one. So I start using a stocking one of the kids or Chris has left lying around. Then I just start going to the grocery store. Meats, vegetables, fish, cashews, and a couple pairs of stockings and pantyhose for the missus. Then I see on television the caps competitive swimmers wear, so I go to an athletic apparel store and buy a couple. They really work well, and I think I have found the perfect solution, but to be honest, they are a little tight around the cranium and become uncomfortable after a while. Whatever I use, stocking or swimming cap, I tuck all my hair inside it and pull it over the ear and down and back so nothing is showing. Then I use a roll of clear packing tape I bought at the pharmacy and cut two pieces into 3-inch strips. Then I tear them perfectly down the middle, so now there are 4 strips, each a 1/2 inch in width. I carefully lay them on the counter so they don't get all tangled up and start sticking to one another. Then I apply a single drop of crazy glue to the end of each strip, but never more than 1 drop. The excess will seep everywhere if you apply more than one, and it will be a royal pain to clean up. I place the crazy glue end of the tape on my skin about 1/4 inch below the makeshift skull cap. I use a cloth to wipe off any excess, then apply the other end of the tape to the skull cap, smoothing it down as much as possible. This has the effect of getting rid of a lot of skin around the eyebrows by pushing the skin up. As I get older and jowls appear, I also use the clear tape and crazy glue method behind the ear. Don't pull too much, just a little. Then I use the tape and glue to give my forehead just a little lift. Finally, I take a piece of tape and wrap it around the skull cap so nothing moves. Voila! A mini facelift, and it probably cost $10. I am proud to say my face looks pretty damn good and makes it very difficult for anyone to recognize me as Bruce. It has been achieved only after extensive trial and error. Many different styles of tapes are used. The crazy glue is quite genius, if I say so myself. I realized that when I sweat, none of the tape, no matter how sticky, would work. I could not afford to have my eyebrows suddenly start drooping down. So I searched for an alternative method, which is when it popped into my head that doctors sometimes use a similar substance on cuts instead of stitches. There is only one drawback to crazy glue. It can sometimes stick to your skin so much that it takes a little piece of skin with it when you pull it off. Another reason to be careful about how much you use. This, on occasion, has created mysterious red dots on my forehead, but fortunately, I have makeup to cover it. After I perform my little facelift, I do my makeup. Then I put my wig on, which always has bangs, so none of the clear strips show. Another issue is waistline. You want a tight one. But men in general don't have a good one. Our waist is too wide. Women have a much smaller waist area and a more defined buttocks. I buy a big box of clear plastic wrap, any brand will do. I take the roller out of the box. I start at my side and wrap it around my waist and lower chest 4 or 5 times. It has the effect of a girdle, but is much thinner and lighter. Then I put on Spanx or something similar to further tighten. Voila! I have taken 4 inches off my waist. I look better and better, more and more like a woman, or more precisely, the image I have of what I should look like as a woman. But these are band-aids. I am becoming increasingly unhappy, feeling more and more worthless and invisible, sleepwalking through life until it is over. I also think about my dad, who died in 2000 at the age of 77. He had cancer and then it spread. I had a home in Lake Tahoe, California, at the time, and he had been living there, his marriage to my mom ending in divorce after 41 years. I wasn't in Tahoe when he died because I was on a business trip. Several days earlier, I had come into his room. "I just want you to know that you are a really good dad. You raised great children. You were a really great inspiration to me. I love you, son. And I love you too, Dad." He drifted off after this. I left the room and never saw him again. He was laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery, where he had always hoped to be buried and where he belonged. The last day I saw him, he said something else in a quiet whisper. "I never should have made it this long." I knew he was talking about Omaha Beach and the sheer luck of surviving while so many others died. It stirred something inside me, not about war and duty and sacrifice, but that there really isn't a second to waste in life, that you must do what you must do before it's too late and your luck is over. Chris and I have been married for more than 20 years. The first 15 or so were good and sometimes great. But the last 5 have been terrible, and I know that Chris, in her heart of hearts, will agree. The challenge for any marriage is that we constantly change as we grow older. For a successful marriage, you have to grow together. We didn't come close. We are at each other's throats. She is frustrated with me all the time. I am worn down. She yells, and then I yell back because I always feel on the defensive. She resents that I never want to leave the house unless it means a hotel room somewhere, that I am content to sit around and watch the History Channel. She resents that I really don't do anything besides tapings for the show. I don't feel like I am living anymore. I need control of my life back. I need control of my finances so I can spend money the way I want to. The house is like a train station, people in and out, out and in. I have no privacy to do what I want to do when I want to do it. I am tired of taking it out on the road so I can spend an hour and a half to get dressed for 15 minutes of freedom. I want to see my first 4 children without friction and the fear that it might upset Chris. I am tired of my life consisting of secret items tucked away in a tiny closet with a lock and key. I cannot go on like this. Chapter 12. Faith. I move into a house in Malibu on the ocean, a significant upgrade from my last rental there. I am alone. In the past, I experienced such isolation and loneliness when I was alone, but I don't feel either of those now. I feel free. I have also started to try to repair my relationships with the 4 oldest Jenner children now that they are adults. There is a lot to fix, I know that, but at least we are beginning to talk regularly. It is a blessed occurrence. But as liberated as I feel about my new life, I still feel uncertain about transition. I am still grappling just as I am considering cosmetic steps to make myself look more feminine. I schedule a consultation in December 2013 for what is known as a tracheal shave to reduce the size of my Adam's apple, since males have bigger ones than females. My assistant Rhonda Kamahira and I enact an elaborate scheme to avoid detection, since such a procedure is often perceived as a precursor to transition. We decide upon a 2-prong approach. We schedule the appointment as if it is for Rhonda, using a phony name. We drive to the medical building in Beverly Hills. Rhonda goes in first, and I trail behind to avoid any suggestion that we are there as a couple. The tabloids would eat up the story. "Sayonara, Chris. Ex-hubby-to-be has new hottie." We get safely inside with no paparazzi attacks, They can be anywhere within minutes because of tips from paid snitches for the tabloids, not to mention passers-by who take video with their smartphones and then try to sell it. Rhonda checks in, and I act as if I am just there for moral support. We go into the doctor's office together for the consultation, and it is only then, in total privacy, we tell him it is actually for me. We leave the same way we came, as if we are separate. Then we jump in the car and we drive home. Roughly 24 hours later, I am in my car when the phone rings. It is Harvey Levin of TMZ, the notorious gossip channel and website that revels in destroying others to the sound of its 20-something employees laughing and tittering as they recount their gotchas on camera, with Harvey sipping out of a cup taller than he is. The call surprises me. Actually, it sickens me, since there is no one you would rather hear from less if you were in the public eye. I pull off to the side of the road. "We heard you went in to have a consultation for a tracheal shave. I have been told that's the beginning steps of transition. It's a huge story." How does he know all the details? The meeting with the doctor was totally private. I am flustered. My back is to the wall. "I just never liked my trachea." I have confirmed that I am thinking of having the procedure done, which will be used by TMZ to suggest that I am in the beginning stages of transitioning into a woman. "Harvey, don't do this to me. This is a huge story. Harvey, please don't do this to me." He keeps talking, but he doesn't respond to the plea. "Harvey, I haven't even spoken to all my children yet about this." He just keeps talking. "By printing this stuff, you destroy lives." He just keeps talking. I can tell he couldn't care less about my pleas. He's going to print the story on their website, which will then go out all over the world with the all but certain implication I am becoming a woman. I go home that night. I try to sleep, but wake up in the wee hours, knowing that a story is most likely going to come out in just a few hours. I pace back and forth across the hallway. The same thought goes through me over and over. "You keep a gun in the house. Why not use it? Just get it over with." I cannot handle this. I cannot deal with this anymore. I have already been labeled a freak in the tabloids. It will only get worse. More paparazzi than ever pursuing and trying to make a buck off of me and my children. First and foremost, my children. I am still in the process of talking to each of them individually to explain the gender issues I have had all my life. And now they are going to see some story that humiliates them and humiliates me. I keep thinking the same thought. "You keep a gun in the house. Why not just use it?" I finally get a few hours of sleep. I leave the house the next morning and walk to an open field to get some air. I have one of my model helicopters with me. I love flying them. It's my only other outlet besides golf to get away from the chaos when I lived with Chris and the kids. I put the helicopter down and just start walking. The breeze off the ocean helps revive me, clear my head. I realize that suicide is never the answer, although I can see how a trans person, in the heat of despair, could be driven to it. For all my pain, I have had a life that has been inspiring and positive to others. I have had every possible creature comfort. I don't want to end it. I don't want to put my kids through something like that. I think, what a terrible way to end my story. Why give Harvey and the tabloids the satisfaction? Because now I am curious to see how it all plays out. How does this story end? All I want now is for the whole public mess to die down, which it eventually does. After about a month, in January 2014, I decide to go ahead with the tracheal shave. But this time, I'm going to be even more careful. I schedule the procedure at 6:30 on a Sunday morning so no other patients will be there and the streets will be empty. I am driven to the office in Beverly Hills, once again by Rhonda. We pull into a small alley. An assistant who works in the medical office is waiting at the back door. She lets me in, a distance of roughly 2 feet. The procedure takes about 3 hours. I am wearing a blue patient smock when I leave with a small bandage over my Adam's apple. I am a little dazed after waking up from the anesthesia. My hair is a mess, frankly witch-like. I look out of it and awful, but who cares? I just want to get home so I can sleep. Rhonda goes out the back door into the alleyway to get the car. She sees a security guard there. She returns with the car and the security guard is gone. She scans in every direction and doesn't see any paparazzi. A nurse escorts me out the back door into the car, once again a distance of 2 feet. Roughly 24 hours later, I am home in Malibu when I get a call from a friend. Have you seen the internet? No. There's a picture of you with a bandage on your neck. They say it means you are becoming a woman. What? I go on the internet. The story is all over the place, further fueling the rumor that I am in the process of transitioning when I myself am still not sure. Thinking seriously about it? Yes. But remember, I came close once before and pulled back. Obviously, a photographer was lurking in the shadows. But who tipped him off? Come to think of it, where did the security guard go? It seems that for every precaution I take, there is always one more I should have taken. Like maybe never leaving the house at all. Why is everything so complicated? I am just trying to be me. Find peace in my soul, and all I do is get destroyed publicly for it and laughed at. Maybe I should leave Malibu, where I have lived for much of my 40 years since the Olympics. Maybe it's better for everyone, including me, to disappear, go somewhere remote. There must be one place in the world where there aren't paparazzi and paid snitches. It is familiar soul-searching again, with a slightly more emphatic result. Fuck all these assholes. They are not going to dictate my life. They are not going to make me leave a place I love. I am not giving in to them, nor am I going to make it any easier for them. They want to take a picture of me? They are going to have to work their asses off for it. The internet uproar over the tracheal shave has made it clear. If I am ever to come to a resolution about my life, I must finish talking to all the kids and tell them about my struggle. I must also stop fooling around with God. It's time for each of us to put our cards on the table. I go to a church called the California Community Church. Chris and I founded it. The pastor there is Brad Johnson, and I trust him and feel I must talk to him privately about what I am going through and what God really thinks. Does God love me? Has he always loved me? Will he still love me? Why did he do this to me? Was it a test of my strength or a condemnation? As I have now discovered, so many trans men and women have asked themselves the very same questions. Why did God do this to me? Is there a reason? And what is the reason? Perhaps Pastor Brad can help me find answers. It is a beautiful day in Malibu when I meet with him at my beachfront rental. There is a particular chair I favor in the dining area because it overlooks the Pacific Ocean and I can hear the waves crashing. Brad comes in and I sit him down in the chair so he is comfortable. I sit facing him and begin to talk. I have some things that have been going through my head all my life, and you may be a little shocked by this. I am going to tell you a lot of things about me that you may not understand, but I will do my best to explain them. This is what I've dealt with all my life. Brad just listens. I sometimes think that when God looked down and made little Bruce, he decided to give me all these great qualities. He decided to make me handsome. He decided to make me a great athlete. He decided to make me kind. He decided to make me smart and articulate. He gave me more than any person could possibly hope for. Perfect, really. And then he threw in one little curveball to see how I would do with it. Something to balance it all out and make my life a little more challenging and interesting. He decided to give me the soul of a female. It was the only way I could justify in my heart that God was not condemning me, but was testing my strength and resolve. Brad then spoke. He still didn't say much, but what he did say spoke volumes. God is not judging you. He loves you. We are all different. I did feel great strength after I heard that. It was a turning point in going through transition without turning back. God does love me. I have not committed a sin. Maybe this is the reason God put me on this earth, to live an authentic life and bring the issue of gender forward. But God is still challenging me. It is not going to be easy. But now I will have His faith to fall back on. It's still not going to be easy. In the process of telling all my kids, I had purposely started with Brandon because of his Gandhi-esque temperament. If anyone was going to be empathetic and supportive, I figured it would be him. I talked openly. We talked openly. He was not surprised, since his mom had told him long ago of my gender dysphoria after he wanted to know why I had breasts. I think in some sense, he had been waiting for roughly 20 years. After we talked for a while, he said this to me, "Dad, I've always been proud to be your son. When I go to the airport and they ask for my ID, they always say, 'Hey, is your dad Bruce Jenner?' Oh, we love Bruce. He comes through here and he's so nice. But Dad, I've never been more proud of you than I am right now." I think that may be the nicest and most important thing anyone has ever said to me. If I could have just stopped with Brandon, I would be home free. But 9 still to go. The older Jenner kids, in their 30s at this point, are wonderful. Like Brandon, Bert and Casey were told of my issues when they were younger and were not surprised. They too are euphoric for me and also proud. Brody had not been told anything until his late 20s and was shocked and stunned. But he also felt it explained a great deal about my emotional distance and absence from his life and the lives of his siblings. If you can't be comfortable with yourself, how can you truly be comfortable with anyone? Then I start with the Kardashians. Kim basically already knows and is totally supportive. So is Courtney. Khloe has the hardest time with it. She is upset because I never specifically told her I was going to transition. She is right. At that time, I still did not know what I was going to do, if transition was even possible. It is something Khloe and I should talk about privately, as we have on many occasions on other sensitive subjects. But we have not, although I have tried. We have not been the same since. Kendall and Kylie are 19 and 17, which also makes telling them the most difficult of all. I am not sure if they will understand it. Kids at that age are still tender and prone to embarrassment. They too are supportive. But the question posed by Kendall reverberates. "So, do we still call you Dad?" "Yes, I'll be your dad always." They have called me that ever since. I